If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to the Dear Lovejoy podcast special. Woo. Today we're both very excited because we're meeting and having a conversation with John Ronson. Many of you all know who he is. If you don't know who he is, he's
where
the
have you been?
Yeah, he's the man who wrote The Men Who Stare at Goats, The Psychopath Test, Frank, and various other books. He's made lots of documentaries, hasn't he? He wrote Okja, that film for Netflix.
Frank, the film, he
helped write Frank, the film.
More recently, The Butterfly Effect, which is the podcast which you talk about.
Yeah, and we'll be discussing really most of these. We even get to discuss one of his early documentaries, which was Stanley Kubrick's Boxes.
Kubrick.
What did I say?
Kubrick.
Stanley Kubrick. I can't say that. Kubrick. Brick. Kubrick.
Kubrick.
Yeah, Stanley Kubrick's Boxes. We're discussing that, and we discuss Who's a Psychopath, which is very good. We obviously discussed the porn industry.
He kept looking at you very, like he was spotting you, I think.
Don't think so. We discussed the porn industry, the adult entertainment industry, I think it's called, isn't it? Which is to do with the Butterfly Effect. We discuss all sorts of things. It's just a fantastic... Oh, and let's not forget... His deadly rivalry. Should we say this? No, we won't say who it is, but there's another...
His nemesis.
There's another person in the industry.
Very quickly, because of some of the nature of the stuff that you talk about in the Butterfly Effect, maybe not one for the kids again, this one.
Yeah.
It gets a bit graphic, doesn't it?
Yeah. So yeah, be careful. It's adult content, probably not best around children. Anyway, he's a brilliant guy. He knows so much, and a pleasure to have him in my kitchen. Let's meet him, John Ronson.
This is just a guide to modern life. Modern life is hard to get just right. It can frustrate you and annoy. And if it does, write into Dear Lovejoy.
Hi, John. Welcome to my kitchen. Thank you for coming here.
Tim, it's a pleasure to be here.
First thing is, I bought you a present. I buy all my guest presents. And I tell you why I bought you this present, because when I met you on Sunday brunch, I was thinking, you've seen and witnessed and met so many horrible people in the world, I think, or disturbed people, that I thought you needed something nice in your life. And Haemin Sumin, you might have this book. Have you got this book?
No, the things you can see only when you slow down.
So he's a monk from South Korea, and I met him when he came on my show, and he's just, everything he says is very peaceful. Right. And this book, you will love this book. Take it with you on your travels.
Thank you so much.
And it's in my top five books of all time, because every time I feel a bit sad, I read that. Mm. And it's just very wise words about life. Buddhist words, basically. Right. So enjoy that in your travels.
Well, thank you. I could do with being a little bit calmer.
you do get to meet quite a lot of...
Yeah.
What's the word I'm looking for? Ugly people, as in...
Yeah. Can I say so? So I just spent a year on porn sets in California for this podcast, The Butterfly Effect, where it's not, I mean, it's actually full of really lovely people. The porn world is a surprisingly kind of collegiate and lovely place. Anyway, a couple of days ago, my producer, Lena, who I was on all of these porn sets with, said that she was at an event and somebody came up to her and said, "Can I ask you a question?" And she was like, "Yeah." And he said, "What's it like being on a porn set with John Ronson?" And I said to Lena, "That's such a niche question. It's like, what's it like being at an execution with David Sedaris?"
Right. Well, we'll get to the Butterfly Effect a little bit later on. Okay. But where do you live now? You're based in over there?
I live in New York.
Yeah.
Why? Whenever I'm back in London, I'm sort of like, why do I live in New York?
Why do you live in New York?
I like it geographically. I like the fact that I'm halfway between London and Los Angeles because I think I probably love London and Los Angeles more than New York. So living halfway between the two in a way is quite good because it means I can go back and forward. So that's one reason. I like America. It still is very romantic to me, the idea that I can get on a plane and 2 hours later I'm in Cleveland these places are still kind of mysterious to me. So there's that. I've got some nice friends there. There's a little gang of us kind of expats, me and Maeve Higgins, the comedian, and Mona Chalabi, who acts for The Guardian, and Emmy the Great, the singer. We all kind of hang out together.
That's cool.
Yeah, so, you know, there's some good stuff too.
So how would you describe, for anyone who doesn't know you, by the way, you do, which I'm sure Mark and myself are massive fans of yours. You've done so many things, which we'll discuss about a little bit later on. But what would you say your job is? How would you describe your job now?
Well, because I've started doing fiction as well as non-fiction, because I'm writing screenplays as well now, I get, this is a really pretentious word, but I'm kind of storyteller.
That is exactly what you are. You're a storyteller.
So I go off. What I've done most of my life is that I'll go off and have kind of adventures in shadowy, strange places people don't normally get to go to. And then I try and, you know, tell stories about them, which are both about those places, but also hopefully they have a kind of, the adventures have a sort of resonance about the whole world. So it's not just about me going off to a Ku Klux Klan compound or Broadmoor and tell a story about, you know, what I found there. But it's also a story that kind of, you know, sheds light on more than that.
That's what I've written here. John tells good stories. That's one of my questions. That is your job. John tells good stories. Because you do, and we'll talk about the butterfly effect later, but it's like when you start, you just feel like you're starting, you're opening the page of a story. It's fantastic. I really did enjoy that. So how did you get your job in the first place then? How did you create your being John Ronson?
Actually, I do remember. So when I was in the mid-80s, I was the social secretary for the Polytechnic of Central London.
Yeah.
And in fact, the social secretary at our neighbouring college was Ricky Gervais. So,
wow.
Yeah, so me and him used to, share bands and stuff.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And anyway, I hooked up with a couple of bands. One was this Manchester band called The Man from Del Monte, who I'm convinced would have been massive had they not been managed by me. I managed them into the ground. And I became the keyboard player with the Frank Sidebottom O'Blindy big band. And but, you know, I wasn't going to be in the music business.
Right.
And I wasn't making that much money. I moved up to Manchester. I quit college and moved up to Manchester to be with the bands. And a couple of the people in the bands wrote for the local listings magazine, City Life. So I started doing that as well, you know, because it was like paying a little bit of money. And it was just kind of obvious that's what I was good at.
Right.
So I'd go off and have little adventures.
I had a discussion with you when you came on Sunday Brunches. What first attracted me to you was the... I'd watched some of your other work, but I didn't put it all together, actually, bizarrely, until the Psychopath Test. And I saw the book in a shop and people had started talking about it. And it was the cover. And then I started reading it. And that was the first book I think I ever read of yours. And it was so easy to read. I read a lot of books, but I'm not a great reader. Mm. And your book is very, very easy to read. And you said conscious, when we were talking on the show, you said that was a conscious decision to make books that were easy to read for fools like me.
I've always wondered whether I've got a bit of ADD. Like my attention span is very short.
So is mine.
And so when I'm writing... A huge part of me is like, don't bore people. Take out any superfluous words. And in fact, that's the only fun part of the writing process, I think, is when you're nearly at the end and you can just say, okay, that word's not necessary. I can put a full stop there. Just those tiny, final, speeding up kind of details.
Yeah.
So I think that's why my books are easy to read, because I'm very kind of aware of my own attention span. And
you tell a good story and they're easy to read. But those front covers... Whose idea was that? Because they grab you, those covers. Whose idea was that?
It's a Brighton company called Crush Creative who do my UK covers. And it was, my British publisher decided at one point that I was kind of well known enough to have like every book would have a kind of, would echo, the cover would echo each other.
Yeah.
And, you know, not many people get to that. So I feel very privileged.
But are you aware that they're, when you looked at them, you thought that, oh, this will work in a shop? Was there a discussion about it and everything?
No. I just liked it. My very earliest covers weren't so good.
Right.
Like they weren't very good at all. There was a bit of a breakthrough, I think, with the psychopath test.
Let's talk about the psychopath test. Is that your most popular book, do you think? I mean,
I think it's probably sold the most.
You're about to go on a tour.
Yes, Psychopath Night.
Psychopath Night. Don't tell me too much, so I'm going to come and see you.
Okay.
But what's going on? What's happening? I don't even know what I'm doing. I just know it's you. So I went, I'll buy tickets to that. So how does it work?
Well, a couple of years ago, I did this over-ambitious week of shows at the Leicester Square Theatre where I decided to do a different show every night.
Right.
So first night was Louis Theroux night because me and Louis are kind of entwined in each other's lives.
Right.
In that right from the beginning, we like were compared to each other. And I used to joke on stage that we were like conjoined twins in that for one of us to grow stronger, the other one had to die.
Do you ever turn up? Or you ever do a documentary series? You turn up and Louis's there and you go, oh, Louis.
Oh, my God. Yes, that happened. One time when I was writing my first book, then I went to this white separatist compound called Almost Heaven. And it was so far, I always remember passing a sign that said Winding Road, next 76 miles. and we ended up at Almost Heaven. It took like, it was an 8-hour drive from Kalispell in Idaho. And we like pulled up, we were exhausted. And I kind of opened the window and some guy said, oh, you're British. We had another British guy here last week. Louis Theroux.
Louis.
It's like, oh. Yeah, we're constantly, me and Louis are constantly digging into the same stuff.
Are you mates?
We are now.
Right.
There used to be, when we were younger and more ambitious, there was, you can imagine, like, every time you read about yourself, you're in the same sentence as Louis Theroux. I mean, that's going to, like, drive you nuts. So, you know, everybody was, like, comparing us to each other, like, who was, like, winning the humorous journalist horse race, me or Louis? Like, Louis ahead. And it's like, oh, fuck. And I think probably both of us were probably a little bit affected by that. By being constantly compared to each other.
Who won? You got films made.
Yeah. Well, you know what?
Louis
won TV and I won books.
All right, okay.
Which is fine. So then suddenly we realised a few years ago, like, you know, we matured our way out of that destructive thought spiral. and now we're fine. And I feel no competitiveness with Louis anymore at all. Right. And I'm sure he doesn't with me.
He's very good, isn't he?
He's really good. And as a person, I like him very much. And, you know, I've had lots of like, lunches with him and stuff like that. So the first night was Louis night. Yep. Then the second night was shame night, which was appropriate because I'd taken too much melatonin to sleep.
Right.
And I was too groggy and the night was shit. so I feel ashamed by shame night. Then the third night was mystery guest night. It was them night and mystery guests were Russell Brand and Adam Curtis, which is great.
Wow.
Yeah. And then the fourth night was Adam Buxton night. And then the fifth night was psychopath night. And I brought on these two women, both of whom inspired, neither of them are in the psychopath test, but they both really inspired the book.
All right.
I'm not going to tell you.
No, don't, because I want to come.
Yeah, exactly. So, and it worked really well. The one thing I will say, because it's quite ambiguous, is that both of these women have had experiences in the mental health world.
Right.
And their experiences are kind of diametrically opposed to each other. And they're not the sort of people who you would imagine should be on the same show. But they work brilliantly on the same show.
There's something amazing about psychopaths, though, isn't there? We love that word. And as soon as the show finished, when you came on Sunday brunch, my mum phoned me up and said, I want to read that book. And it's really strange because it's not the sort of book I'd imagine my mum to read, but she likes the idea. She said, I spent the whole of my career working with psychopaths. Right. My mum was quite a strong woman and she had a good career in sales. And so she believed that everyone around her was like, maybe my mum was, who knows? But can you now spot a psychopath, do you think?
I think if somebody acts very psychopathically, like murders me, no, I'm kidding. If somebody acts in a way that's like really straight out of the checklist, I can spot it. You know, I was telling this story to somebody the other day, like a few years ago, actually a long time ago, because my son was a baby and he's 19 now. Mm. I got into like a road rage incident in Froome. And we were on our way to Babington House, which is this like fancy place near Froome. And I got into this road rage incident. This guy was like, this boy racer was like speeding up. And anyway, I pulled in. We didn't know the way, so I was driving pretty slowly. And I pulled into Babington House, and then he pulled in behind me and he leapt out of his car. And it was this very kind of handsome, buffed guy, blonde hair. And it's like he came out and was like squaring up to me, like, why the fuck were you like so driving so slowly? And I said, is it all right for me to swear on this podcast?
Yeah, fine. Okay.
I said, I've got a baby in the car. And he said, I don't give a fuck about your baby. And then it turned out that he was one of the personal trainers at Babington House.
Oh.
But he'd left the job, but he was still going out with the woman who was managing the place at the time. So I said to her, like, I want you to, like, this guy had like really accosted me. And she said, that's my boyfriend. And I said, I want you to call the police. And she's like, no. I've never told the story before,
right,
by the
okay.
way. I said, I've spent time with like Nazis, like I've been with the Ku Klux Klan, I've been with white supremacists, I've been with, you know, militant Islamists, and, you know, this guy is dangerous. This guy's more dangerous than Nazis that I've been with. You should be careful. And I had no idea what happened to the two of them as a relationship. But, you know, all of the things that happened there, the kind of grandiosity, the lack of empathy, the impulsivity, like all of the ways he acted was straight out of the psychopath checklist.
Yeah, well, actually it's interesting because when I first read the book, I thought that's what I was going to get, just a checklist of what a psychopath was. And then it turns out to be nice stories instead. So it's a fantastic read. Are Harvey Weinstein and Kevin Spacey psychopaths?
You know, I worked with Kevin Spacey a little bit. I wrote the book The Many Stare at Goats.
Yep.
And it was turned into a movie with Kevin Spacey. I didn't see any weird. I was on set for a little while, and I was on a publicity tour with him, and I didn't see any sexual harassment there. Harvey Weinstein. You know, it's kind of, I should caveat this by saying it's kind of psychopathic to label people from afar as psychopaths. there's a kind of lack of empathy there. But, you know, one of the items on the checklist is promiscuous sexual behaviour. Another is lack of empathy. Lack of empathy is like the big one. Just came out last night that he was hiring ex-Mossad agents. Did you read this?
No.
Ronan Farrow, who's becoming this like incredible investigative journalist, Mia Farrow's son, has just brought out this thing about how Harvey Weinstein was employing Mossad agents to spy on the women.
Who are they?
Like Israeli secret
right,
service.
Okay.
Yeah, to spy on the women who were making accusations against him. I mean, gee, you know, whoa. So, you know, all of those things. I can't tell you whether or not Harvey Weinstein's a psychopath, but I can tell you that thing that he did and that way that he behaved are all straight out of the psychopath checklist.
I suppose Kevin Spacey as well. He's in trouble because of Frank Underwood. The character is obviously a psychopath or a narcissist or something, and so Kevin Spacey, everyone knows that's his latest role that everyone knows him for, and we're all thinking that's who he is.
Yeah. Well, okay, so I think there's a lot. I mean, it seems that Kevin Spacey was a kind of serial offender. What's happening at the moment is people who, you know, absolutely and uncategorically deserve it are being, you know, taken down, like Harvey Weinstein, and it seems Kevin Spacey. There's so many accusations that come out. But as always with these things, then it gets, you know, there's this list in New York circulating called the Shitty Media Men List. Have you heard of this?
No, I haven't, no.
Okay, so in the wake of Harvey Weinstein, a bunch of women in New York put together this spreadsheet called Shitty Media Men, and it's like a list of you know, men who have behaved inappropriately in the New York media. Anyway, I it says at the top of the list, do not show this list to any men. So I had to find a gender traitor. Let me see the list. So I've seen the list.
Right.
Anyway, the accusations on the list are everything from rape through to creepy DMs. Right. So, you know, this is obviously, you know, the problem when
DMs being direct messages. Yeah.
So this is the problem when something like this happens, is that, you know, the list is okay because it says at the top of the list, like, these are all unsubstantiated rumors.
Right.
Take these accusations with a grain of salt. So this list isn't irresponsible, and it's not supposed to be circulated. So it is responsible, but when you've got a list which conflates really serious accusations through to sort of, you know, not that, you know, slightly creepy accusations, you know. That's rife with problems. But I'd say that's a kind of small criticism for the fact that, you know, I've spent a lot of time in Hollywood, and I've met some absolutely lovely, delightful people, and I've met some monsters. And I think it's about time that the monsters were taken
when you
down.
Say monsters because of sexual things, or monsters because they're just horrible people?
I never saw any, I've not seen any weird sexual stuff at all, but I've seen, like, just bullies, like alpha male bullies.
When I read your book, it was funny because I assume industries like the film industry, Hollywood, media, music, sport, they attract the psychopaths, obviously, because there's a lot of adulation and things like that.
Yeah, so one of the items on the checklist is need for stimulation, proneness to boredom. So I think if you take that one seriously, then I think it's wrong to think of psychopaths as being like Richard Branson, for instance. I can't imagine as a psychopath, because, you know, somebody who's kind of spent their life building up, slowly building up. You know, the psychopaths are attracted to kind of quick kill businesses.
Right.
Get in, you know, make a fortune and then get out again. So hedge funds, journalism.
Media, because when we all read your book, I think you talked about a few cases of people in the media and TV, and I worked in the TV when it was rife with coke and whatever else was going on at the time, and you saw these people and you were like, my god, there's some really, and it sort of resonated with me that there were these people who I don't think they can exist anymore because there's too many checklists. But I suppose with the sexual stuff, that's still happening, but with the other sort of the bullying behavior is stopped in the media. I don't know about Hollywood, I doubt it in Hollywood, but.
Well, actually, I was saying to somebody, because I was just in Los Angeles last week, and every meeting I had, everybody was talking about, you know, the whole Harvey Weinstein thing.
Yeah.
And who's going to be next? You know, Hollywood is kind of rife with this. And I said to one of them, like, you know, if you put the sexual stuff to one side, you've got all of these, like, young up-and-coming producers who kind of want to emulate Harvey Weinstein in terms of, like, being this kind of bully, alpha male, you know, sort of biggest dick in the room kind of thing. And I wonder whether that might die out a little bit, and that could be another legacy of the takedown of Harvey Weinstein. And I hope so, because I can't stand people like that. And I've been, you know, I've never been a victim of any kind of, you know, sexual stuff, but I've definitely been a victim of that kind of bullying stuff.
Is it a power thing? Bill Clinton, Monica Lewinsky, is that a psychopathic thing to do? Because he's sort of used her, abused her, and then denied it all, etc. Is that from afar, John?
Well, you know what? I've become good friends with Monica Lewinsky.
Oh.
Yeah, and I say I didn't know her the other night. And one thing I really like about Monica is she won't... When my public shaming book came out, So You've Been Publicly Shamed, it was a book that tried really hard to not be tribal. Like, a lot of people who think about public shaming are like, you know, people on the left are like, you know, look at all of those, you know, alt-right you know, racist, white supremacists who were kind of doxing feminist writers. And people on the right are like, look at all of those social justice warriors who are kind of attacking us. And neither side can see that they do bad shit too.
Yeah.
And what my book was trying to be non-tribe. It was trying to look at public shaming, not in a sort of factional way. And what I really like about Monica is that she feels exactly the same way. And whenever anybody's ever asked her about the Bill Clinton thing, she says, like, yes, he abused his position, but this was a mutual relationship. So, yeah, she's really good at not because in the 90s...
But the denial, though, John, which he said, no, nothing to do with me. And I didn't happen, nothing. That surely is a slightly psychopathic, that behaviour.
Yeah, well, pathological lying and not being embarrassed when caught lying, that's on the checklist. So I keep going back to the checklist because that's the sort of industry definition.
How many points are there on the checklist?
20.
20, that's right. Yeah,
I very clearly remember Robert Hare saying, you know, it's not just pathological lying, it's the lack of embarrassment at being caught in a lie. That's a real kind of telling sign.
Do psychopaths like being psychopaths?
Yeah, I think by and large, most of them do. There's no empathy, there's no guilt, there's no remorse.
I'm just better than you.
Yeah.
That's what they think.
And they're not sort of, they're not like tied down by the things that keep us morally good.
Are women psychopaths? Are there plenty of those or is it generally a male thing?
Okay, this is what I know about that. In the old days, when I say the old days, I mean up to about sort of 2012, 2013, there were five, I think I'm right what I'm about to say, there were five units for psychopaths in Britain. They've been closed down now. They're called DSPD units. And four of them were for men and one was for women. So I think that's a kind of anecdotal breakdown.
One in five psychopaths are women.
Yeah.
Not one in five. Women one in five women are psychopaths, which I nearly said, and I'm really sorry. How many psychopaths turn into killers then that we think, because we, you know, Jeffrey Dahmer's of the world and things like that. Fred West's.
I think not very many at all.
No.
In fact, when you look at the checklist, there's only, of the 20 items, only one or two of them allude to violence.
Right.
So I think it's very easy to you basically have to score on like 15 of the 20 items to be labelled a clinical psychopath.
Right.
And so you can be kind of manipulative, deceitful, but not violent. That's, I'd say most, you know, the large majority of psychopaths aren't violent.
Are you created or are you born a psychopath?
Well, this is a very big and interesting topic. So Robert Hare, who's like the king of psychopathy study, would veer towards you're born that way. You're another species. Anti-Hare people, and there are anti-Robert Hare people, would say, you know, that's a really unfair way of looking at humans because you have to look at what happened in somebody's childhood. So there's an eminent psychiatrist called James Gilligan who said to me one time, I talk about it, I meet him for So You've Been Publicly Shamed, and he says he spent his life in secure hospitals and high security prisons in Massachusetts.
Yeah.
And he said that every murderer, pimp, you know, violent criminal that he has met was harboring a central secret, and that was that they felt ashamed, deeply ashamed of things that have happened to them in their childhoods, parental abuse and so on. And the more, the worse you're treated as a child, then the worse you behave as an adult. And then he said all violence is an attempt to replace shame with self-esteem, which doesn't obviously mitigate. And he's had to spend his life saying to people, that doesn't mean, you know, that doesn't mean that I'm...
There's a famous case in America where a guy ended up going nuts, shooting lots of people, And in his suicide note, he said, please examine my brain. I don't feel normal. So they cut him open and he had a blood clot in the brain. And that's led a lot of people to think that when you kill or you, which is a tough thing for humans to get around this, by the way, but if you kill or you do something bad, that it's not really your fault. It's what's happened to you as a child, or it's because you've got a blood clot or don't. And then you've got to start asking the question, can you fix it? If you can fix it, then is that person guilty? So we've got a lot of problems with this coming now in the future, because we're looking more at the brain and how we are actually machines taking inputting data, and how we use that data is potentially not our fault.
Yes. And of course, there's the famous story about Phineas Gage, this 19th century railway worker, and I can't remember who he was, and, you know, perfectly nice and a lovely guy. And then there was an explosion. He was building a railway track and a shard of metal went through his brain and affected his frontal lobe. And his personality totally changed. He became like vulgar and disinhibited. And you know, for neurologists, he's like a sort of ground zero of how brain injuries can change your personality. I said, when I was on the Robert Hare course, teaching me how to identify psychopaths, I said to somebody there, like, shouldn't you feel sorry for them? Like, if it's a brain anomaly, if it's not their fault. And he said, why should we feel sorry for them? They don't give a shit about us. But this is a very complicated,
it's a fascinatingly complicated area. It is, and it's going to change as we learn more about the brain. And this is the thing, we're going to have to start sort of looking at it and thinking, whose fault is it? You know.
In the end, you know, you take what, you bring your own baggage to this. Like, I'm a sort of humanist, so I veered towards the whole James Gilligan, violence is an attempt to replace shame with self-esteem. But that's because I've got my own liberal humanist baggage. You know, somebody else who's been like married to a psychopath, they're not going to, you know, they're not going to feel James Gilligan-y, they're going to feel Robert Harry.
Apparently, as humans also, we I've got no facts to back this up apart from I heard on a podcast, which is where I get most of my stuff from. But apparently, as humans, we quite like revenge. We like that feeling, which is why we used to, I mean, I can't believe people used to do it, but they used to go and watch hangings and hung, drawn and quarters. People used to turn up to watch them because they felt good that someone bad was having something done to them. It's, go back to your book, which we'll talk about a bit in a minute, So You've Been Publicly Shamed. I think it's part of that. Oh, I feel really good because I'm bringing that person down. We feel, you know, you discussed that in your book. And I think that's an interesting side of things. If we decide that people are killing people or hurting people because, and it's not their fault, how are we going to get our revenge if we can't, if we try to fix them with doctors or medicine rather than go, right, going to stick them in prison? We're not getting our revenge then, are we?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I should read this book that you gave me. Yes. You can see only when you slow down.
Exactly. What is the difference? But I was just going to say, actually, Alfred Hitchcock probably did more to create the psycho with the film Psycho, the psychopath and how we feel what a psychopath is. Is that true, do you think? With that film, it became so huge and everyone just assumed psychos were all killers.
Well, okay, I'll tell you some things that psychopaths aren't. They tend not to be delusional. So they know, like, they don't have hallucinations. They can't be made better with medication. They're not psychotic. I mean, there's probably people out there who are both psychopathic and psychotic, but psychosis isn't an item on the psychopath checklist. So it's more sort of, you know, being psychopathic is more kind of personality trait. There's an absence of empathy, but it's not a mental illness.
Right.
Like psychosis is, which makes it much harder to treat.
What's the difference between a psychopath, a sociopath and a narcissist? They all seem to be all the rage at the moment.
Well, okay, so basically it's all, take narcissist out of the equation for a second.
Right.
When you look at the definition of psychopath and sociopath, it's basically the same thing.
Right.
And when the psychopath test came out, I did a This American Life of it, and they got a fact checker to try and answer that question, and they came up with the same thing. There's no real difference between psychopath and sociopath, but there is, I think, a difference between that and a narcissist.
Narcissist. Well, we had Will Storr on the podcast not so long ago with his book Selfie.
Yeah, I'm a big admirer of Will Storr's.
His book is great, all about how we became self-obsessed, and we discussed narcissism in that, because you can create narcissists by telling them they're brilliant or by neglecting them. They're kind of two different ways of going about it, apparently.
Right.
And because we live in a world, especially America and places like that, where we go, you're brilliant, you can be great, you're the best.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we maybe potentially have a president of the United States as a narcissist.
Yeah,
people
well,
would
certainly
say.
Has,
or would he
has
be a psychopath? Points. I don't know. But
yeah. Well, you know,
from afar, John.
From afar. If I had to, you know, one way you can identify psychopaths is to... It's like, is there anything going on under the surface? Like, you know, because one of the items on the checklist is glib superficial charm. It's not charm, it's superficial charm.
Right.
Another item is shallow affect, which is an inability to experience a range of emotions. And you really do get this sense, like I've met enough high-scoring psychopaths to know that, you know, one of the weirdest thing about a really high-scoring one is this eerie sense that there's nothing going on under the surface. You're
right,
just looking at it's like this
fake smile type thing. Yeah.
I personally don't think that about Donald Trump. I think there's too much going on under the surface, which is more narcissistic, I'd say, than psychopathic.
We had Mir Kreiger on the podcast, and we discussed, he's one of the leading sleep experts in the world, and we discussed sleep deprivation and how eventually if you don't sleep for enough time you start going mad, and we discussed Thatcher who had four or five hours sleep. He said, well, you can't survive on that as an adult, and eventually, you know, they're linking it a lot to things Alzheimer's and dementia later on in life. You don't sleep enough, they're finding that now. But he actually sent me an email the other day, because I talked about Donald Trump, we talked about Barack Obama, Clinton, they all finish their terms and they're exhausted. And they're sort of trying to look at correlations between bad decisions, bad ideas at the end of their terms when they're knackered.
Huh.
And he was saying that, I don't know whether they found them yet, but he sent me an article and someone had written about Donald Trump is acting like someone who's sleep deprived because he tweets in the middle of the night, and don't ever do anything in the middle of the night because that's when your brain's going a little bit.
Oh, I've done that. I've woken up in the middle of the night, checked my emails, and then I've emailed
fired
somebody.
Off.
Yeah, and then the next morning I've looked at the email and it's like paranoid. It's
yes.
Like,
oh.
It's like, are you sure they're giving us our share of royalties?
Yes, yeah. Never do anything late at night. Final one on psychopaths before we move on. Stanley Kubrick, I watched your documentary years ago, Kubrick's Boxes, which is brilliant. And I can't remember it all. And I must admit, I went online last night to watch it, and I can't watch it in full anymore.
I think it's been taken down.
Yeah.
Yes, annoying.
So I watched bits and bobs of it to try and remember. But I do remember, I mean, the stuff of the Full Metal Jacket's brilliant where they're sitting there. And I do remember the photographs where he had his nephew, and he got to
Manuel.
It's a great documentary. That should be re-released somehow.
You can. There is a way that you can see it. It is on the... It's a special feature on the 20th anniversary Blu-ray edition of Full Metal Jacket.
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. So for anyone who doesn't know what it is, he had thousands of boxes and they let you open them.
Yeah.
And you made a documentary out of it.
Yeah.
And there was just bizarre stuff in there, like he would get the whole of Commercial Road photographed and sell a tape together rather than go there to look for somewhere to shoot.
Yeah.
I can't remember what film it was.
Eyes Wide Shut.
Eyes Wide Shut. He'd rather look at a load of photographs than all. Was he a hoarder? Was he a psychopath? Was he a perfectionist? What was he, did you decide in the end?
Well, I've thought this a couple of times in my career, that the closer you get to an enigma, the more explicable. What's the word? No, explicable.
Explicable.
Yeah. Like the more you can understand,
right.
Like the less mysterious an enigma is, the closer you get. And actually, I don't find Stanley Kubrick particularly mysterious anymore. I think a lot of the things that he did were very rational. I don't think he's a hoarder, even though he kept everything, but because he lived in this like massive estate between St. Albans and Harpenden.
Yeah.
And a few people, you know, a few times, like his family said to me, "Well, you didn't have to throw anything away because we've got like, look at all the space we have. It's like, it's huge."
Yeah.
Stable blocks, porter cabins. So I don't think he's a hoarder. He's definitely not a not a.
But he kept all the, he kept all his fan mail.
Yeah, but that, that was rational. So this is one of the things I thought, whoa, how do you explain this? And it's like there was a box of fan mail, and at the top he'd written FP, fan positive, FN, fan negative, FC, fan crank. And so the reason why fan crank was if he was ever killed, like murdered, the police would have a list of suspects.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
And the FP and FN, that was a reason too, because if they were, you know, he was really obsessed with making sure that like the film was projected properly, like if the Albuquerque Odeon was going to be showing Barry Lyndon, he'd want to make sure that it was like being properly projected, like the way that he intended it. As a perfectionist, he was definitely a perfectionist. Yeah. So then what they'd do is they'd go to the FP box, find somebody from Albuquerque and say, will you do us a favour? Will you go to the Odeon and make sure that the film is looking good?
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay, that's so good. Yeah. How many boxes were there?
I remember Jan Hall and his brother-in-law said to me, 1,000.
Did you halfway through think, was every moment when you opened a box going, this is brilliant, or were you halfway through going, why have I taken on this task?
The latter. it took me a good few years to go through every box. I do think I saw everything by the end. You know what? At one point, a lot of the stuff was moved to the University of the Arts London in the Elephant and Castle.
Yeah.
Christiane Kubrick, sort of, it was too much like the ghost of Stanley sort of hovering over the house.
Right.
She said all of these notepads are getting like more and more faded and the person's like so dead, you know, when the paper's gone yellow. So she donated a bunch of the stuff to the University of the Arts London. And I remember I went there after it had been moved and there was this shelf. And somebody had written on the shelf, like on a post-it note, don't allow John Ronson to see any of this stuff. So I then like immediately looked through all of it. And most of it, you can completely understand why I wasn't supposed to see it, because there were some test shots of naked actors for naked scenes in the film. There was like private correspondence about, you know, like letters he'd written to his kid's headmaster and, you know, that kind of stuff. But there was one little box and it was memos. And it was like loads of memos. And it was things like, please ensure there's a supply of melons in the house at all times.
Right.
And I sneakily moved the memos from the don't show to John Ronson to the it's okay to show John Ronson.
Into the documentary it went.
Yeah.
So your final conclusion on him was genius?
I mean, and you know what? It's like Jan Harlan said to me one time, like, don't question his working method, because we all have our working methods, and that's true. You know, we all have our different ways of working, and you know, his was probably a bit more extreme than other people, but it was a working method. You know, that's just what it was.
Yeah. Geniuses, Fabian.
Is Fabian
a genius? I'll have to explain who that is quickly. The Butterfly Effect, fantastic documentary you did.
Yeah, which is just now available on iTunes. We've taken it out from behind the Audible paywall, which is where it was for 3 months.
But it was free.
Yeah, but
I got it for free. I couldn't believe it.
I know.
I kept looking over my shoulder going, why am I not paying for this?
Yeah, that was Audible's decision. Like the deal I had with Audible was that, you know, they'd pay for it and in return it would stay behind their paywall for 3 months. But then I think they just decided to make it like, I don't know, I guess like bait, like you get it for free and then you'll subscribe to Audible and get all of their other stuff. And so that was their idea.
Do you know if it worked for them?
I think it did really well.
It did.
It got to number one in the audiobook charts in both this country and the United States.
How long did it take you to make?
A year and a half.
Okay, so it's about the adult industry and... Why don't you just tell us the beginning of it and then we can get to Fabian, because it's a great story for anyone who doesn't know, and it's the top of your podcast and on the trailer, so you might as well tell us.
Sure. So this was in about 2013, I think, 2014. I was in Los Angeles staying at the Chateau Marmont, which is very fancy. I don't stay there anymore because it's too expensive and a bit hipstery.
Right.
But I was staying there back then. And I had a rendezvous with a porn star because I was interviewing her for my public shaming book.
Right.
And I'd never met a porn star before. Anyway, so I was in my room and the receptionist phoned and said, your guest is waiting for you downstairs. So I went downstairs and everybody in the hotel lobby was dressed exactly like I am now dressed and kind of, how do you describe it?
You're in a casual hoodie, sweatpants.
Inconspicuous
stuff,
greys and blues, like the sort of, you know, the outfit of the media introvert.
Right, okay.
And except for this porn star who was dressed in this kind of very bright, very tight dress, very high heels. And she looked like this kind of great mad peacock, like this otherworldly, mysterious person. So I walked towards her and I just happened to glance over at the receptionist. And he was looking at her. He didn't realise anyone was looking at him, looking at her. And the look on his face was one of total contempt.
Mm.
Like, what are you doing in my vicinity, you sex worker? Yeah, that was the look on his face. Whether or not he recognised her as a porn star or not, obviously I don't know. But it did make me think that a lot of people are very comfortable with porn people when they're on their computers, but not in their vicinity.
Which is huge. So then you go on to make the documentary. Before you get into that, just talking about audio documentaries, they're becoming big, aren't they? Serial, S-Town, all those sort of things. And they're good to listen to. And when you were coming, I want to make documentaries now, audio ones, not visual ones, even though I love visual ones.
Yeah. They're so much easier. They're so much less stressful.
But it's not just that. What I was thinking about it, knowing that I was interviewing you, is that because you're very good at telling a story, and your voice is fantastic, by the way, for them, you're painting pictures for me, and I'm seeing I don't know what this porn star looks like, I didn't bother, and you talk about...
Take a picture if you want.
All right. You've got one on your phone.
Well, I can Google her.
But what you were doing is interesting, because as you were going through all the porn stars that you meet on the journey, I actually didn't Google them, which would have been so easy. Right. I thought, I'm leaving this to what I'm thinking. My daughters read a lot of books and they always say they hate it when anyone puts a picture in it because it ruins the imagination.
I'm about to ruin it by showing you a picture of the woman that I met in the hotel lobby.
Okay, right.
So anyway.
No, it's cool. That's cool. He showed me one with her clothes on, by the way.
It was her Wikipedia
To let you know, save my blushes. So what made you decide to make that into an audio documentary then? Because you're a visual documentary maker. Yeah. Why did you go audio?
Well, I've gone off visual documentaries.
Oh, why?
I just don't like the stress of it, you know? I don't like the fact that if you go to, you know, if you get on the plane from New York and go to L.A., you know, on a hunch that you might get a good, you know, moment if you turn up at this porn set on this day. If you do, it's like, you know, for Audible, you know, for the podcast, it was just me and my producer, Lena. It meant it didn't cost any money. It just cost the plane fares. It's kind of really low stress and we can go on a hunch. But if you do that with a TV crew, it suddenly becomes like a big deal, you know? It's like, you've got to get something and it really matters. So there's the stress of making it. But also, as a consumer of nonfiction, I tend to listen to podcasts more than anything now.
Yeah.
You know, I tend to listen to podcasts more than I watch documentaries. I definitely listen to audiobooks more than I read physical books. And I've always felt that you should work for things that you yourself are a fan of.
Which is why we started doing this, because Mark and I love podcasts. And so we said, come, we've got to go and make one.
Yeah.
And now people start listening to these. And what people love, because we were struggling, being in broadcast, both of us, Mark's got a radio background, I've got a TV and radio background, and being in broadcast, both of us kept on going, they have to be half an hour long, no more than that. And then we started doing the long form ones, which I'm doing with you, and we did with Russell Kane, and we're doing with all our authors and stuff. People going, I love it, they could be longer. You know, what? You know, they're running an hour long, and they're going, yeah, we love it, we want more. It's great, isn't it?
It's really good. You know, you can be very structurally adventurous in podcasts. There's no gatekeeper. And that's another thing. I love having no gatekeeper. I'm sick of gatekeepers.
Leave all that. Go on. What do you mean by that? Gatekeeper?
Well, you know, like permission to go off and do a story.
Yeah.
You know, I hate that.
And also when you do a documentary and it's then got to be on TV, it's more people have invested in it.
Exactly.
They need...
Financially, and then you get notes and...
I did a documentary with David Beckham and the notes kept coming back. We need more Victoria in it. And I want to talk to him about football and about what it's like to be a British player in Spain and stuff like that. We want Victoria. But I understand there's nothing wrong with that. I didn't want to do it. At all.
Notes are really important, you know, especially if they're, you know, given by thoughtful. Yeah, those are good.
Yeah.
But there's something... But, you know, saying that, I'm very good at being my own editor. Like, I'm really good at I have few genuine skills, but one is that I'm a very good fresh eye for my own work. I can go back to a piece of writing a couple of days later and instinctively know how to make it better.
How often do you start an idea, documentary or book, and then give up on it because you realise it's going nowhere?
It's happened a couple of times. Yeah. It's happened a few times. It's always frustrating.
Well, leave it. Go on.
Well, just I guess you just have to think, well, that's just part of the process, you know? So what I was going to say is that, you know, podcasts are a place to be very kind of adventurous in terms of structure. So, you know, the long form conversation like this is new. And then, you know, but also the kind of opposite to that, which is what I did in The Butterfly Effect, which is very kind of intricate. Yeah. You know, that's structurally adventurous too, because the entire series, I should explain, is let me go back to the hotel in Los Angeles for a second. That look on the face of the hotel receptionist kind of piqued my interest, and I decided to like start reading blogs written by porn people, because I was just curious about what their lives were like and what their concerns were, and the same name kept coming up over and over again, which was Fabian. There was a man called Fabian that they were all very annoyed with, and Fabian, to cut a long story short, was the man who gave the world Pornhub. So Fabian got
free porn.
Yeah, free porn. Fabian got very, very rich. And they all lost all of their money because of the tube sites. So my entire series is about the consequences of Fabian's business plan, and it goes to some really crazy places, you know. So if I go to this consequence, then through to that consequence, then through to that consequence. So structurally, it's very adventurous, and you know, you can do that in podcasts.
And it is amazing because the porn industry is huge because we've all got smartphones. And I remember first seeing an iPad around a friend's house, and they said, "What do you think of this?" And excuse me for being crass, so I said, "Oh, it's a wipe on, wipe off wank mag, isn't it?" Basically, right. because I just thought to myself, young boys who'd been buying, I really apologise for this because it is quite crude, but young boys were buying FHM and Nuts and all those magazines where they were getting their porn. Mm-hmm. Suddenly they were able to get hardcore porn really easily, really quickly.
Yeah.
And then...
It's changed everything. It's changed human sexuality.
Fabian, right? Yeah. Fabian made it free. So it's... And I was so shocked the other day because I was looking at one of my daughters was on just Googling something, and then a sort of thing came up for hardcore porn. Yeah. But I watched her, and it was like, she wasn't going, "I'm going to click on that." She was like, it just happens in her life all the time. Because what do you do as a parent? She's 15 years old. Yeah. They're aware of what's going on, I think, out there. And hardcore porn is just thrown at them nonstop. So not only is he ruined the porn industry, he's infiltrated all our lives constantly, hasn't he? And our children's lives and everything, this one man.
Yeah, pretty much every child. And you know, unless you live in a country where Pornhub is blocked, like the United Arab Emirates, places like that, you can pretty much guarantee that this is how pretty much every child gets to learn about sex, is through Pornhub.
Right, which just before we get into that, how rich is he?
He's so rich that he has an aquarium with its own diver.
I love that bit. What was he like? Was he a psychopath? Was he a genius?
No, he was a tech utopian. Just
a great idea.
Yeah, Silicon Valley's full of people like Fabian. They're tech utopians, and the problem with being a tech utopian is that it does make you quite amoral. You're only thinking about the tech, you're not thinking about the consequences.
Right.
So he's a very regular, you know, he's Mark Zuckerberg. He's, you know, Mark Zuckerberg didn't know about all the fake news, all the bots in the run-up to the election. He didn't know.
Right.
Like, he, you know, his platform massively changed the world, you know, influenced the election.
Yeah.
And he didn't know.
No.
It's like, that's the thing about tech utopians. They're interested in the tech. They're not interested in the consequences.
So I don't want to give the documentary away because I think people should listen to it. It's really good. But just a few things, just to pick up on there. You said it changed the way people have sex. Interestingly, teenage pregnancy is down.
Mm-hmm.
Yay, good news maybe.
And then why? Because erectile dysfunction is
erectile dysfunction
up.
Is yeah. up.
How? By 1,000% according to...
why is erectile dysfunction up? Why does masturbating to porn online mean that they're getting erectile dysfunction?
I think this is getting into an area I don't really know about, but I can guess. I think one reason is that it gives people a kind of idealized version of, it gives young boys an idealized version of girls. And when they see the kind of reality that, you know, not every girl looks like a porn star, that's going to mangle their psyche a little bit. I think another reason is that, you know, I think a way a lot of, you know, young kids consume Pornhub is to like click on this one for 5 seconds, that one for 5 seconds. You've suddenly got like 20 pages up.
20 and, different women. Yeah, in 20 different minutes, women.
And that's all of that's not how you have sex.
Yeah.
So I think it's to do with that.
The takeaway from the, I've told you this, the takeaway from the documentary for me was the one which I was finding absolutely astonishing is that there's a group of men lining up to have sex with a woman on film. And they were all getting themselves hard by looking at porn on their phones,
yes,
rather than a naked woman who is actually in the room.
Who, by the way, is Casey Calvert, who I've got to know very well and like her very much. You know, she's a very beautiful woman. She was just sitting there and also very lovely and smart. She's one of the stars of The Butterfly Effect.
Yeah.
She was sitting there naked and all the men were watching porn on Pornhub to get aroused. Yeah. Well, Casey was just sort of patiently sitting there.
And the other thing is, how old is Casey? Because you can do teen porn and you can do MILF porn, but there's a bit in between.
Yeah.
Where
you can't, because of search engine optimization. I mean, this is probably the best thing that I mean, best in terms of, when I say best in terms of like extraordinary discoveries.
Yeah.
Is that because of the search engine optimizers up in Montreal where Pornhub comes from, it's like, you know, everything's now an arms race of searchable keywords. So all the films, you know, the porn films used to be called Women of Influence. Now they're called Stepdaughter Cheerleader Audrey because they have to pile as many keywords into their titles as possible, which means there are people out there who aren't keyword searchable and can't get work. So if you're a 25-year-old adult film actress, you're too young to be a MILF and you're too old to be a teen. But you know what? Casey Calvert bucks the trend because she, I think, probably is in her mid, I'm not exactly sure how old she is, but probably mid-20s. And the reason why she bucks the trend is because she is a Spiegler girl. And there's 31, God, who would have thought I'd know this much about porn? There's 31 Spiegler girls in the Valley. And they're like the golden seal of approval. And Spiegler girls get work. They buck the trend.
Why? Well,
a few reasons. They're professional.
Yeah.
They turn up on time. They're smart. You know, they don't get stoned. You know, they're responsible and professional. And also they are amenable to any sex act at all.
Right.
Like they have no limits.
What did you make of the industry? Because obviously we've all got our preconceived conceptions, but there's a documentary, I believe. I watched it on Netflix where they based,
yeah.
I think they
Hot
say...
Hot Girls Wanted.
Well, isn't there the one which says it's a horrible industry? You know, what did you make of the people in it?
Well, you know what? So Hot Girls Wanted was set... There's two iterations of Hot Girls Wanted. There's a full-length documentary and then there's a series. I haven't seen the series, so I can't comment on this. And I think it may be better. But the documentary was very well made, but it was difficult because it was all set in Miami, where porn is illegal to make. So basically they found this kind of sleazy corner of the porn industry where the girls were being exploited and the men were sleazy and the girls were being forced to do things that they didn't want to do. And because they didn't contextualize it, they made it look like that is the porn industry. And the people in the Valley were like really annoyed. When I started making The Butterfly Effect, I heard over and over again, people in the Valley saying we're really annoyed with Hot Girls Wanted because it makes it look like that's all porn, when in fact that's porn in Miami. In the Valley, it's much more, like, I'm not saying it's perfect. It's not perfect. You've got exploitative boyfriends who are kind of coercing their girlfriends into doing porn and so on. There's a term for them, suitcase pimps, like they turn up with the suitcase. But by and large, I would say the community in the Valley is collegiate. Everyone's nice to each other. It's respectful. Nobody's being forced to do things that they don't want to do. You know, it's probably more respectful than like the Harvey Weinstein stuff we hear about. I don't think that happens in the Valley anywhere near as much. It happens in Hollywood, but it doesn't happen in the Valley. So the people that I spent time with, directors like Mike Quasar, porn stars like Casey Calvert, are completely in control of their destiny, and they're respectful, and it's a positive community.
What about the men on it? Because it's funny, because you, when you do your documentary, I can't remember if you ever mention any men on it, but you do. You just mention women after woman after woman.
Men
are sort of irrelevant, aren't they?
Which is why men have a much longer shelf life than women. Another really negative side of Pornhub is that you've got 18-year-old women all over America who have grown up on Pornhub and think, okay, I'll be a porn star. So they go to the Valley, all the producers shoot them for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
But then there's a whole new batch, 3 weeks later. So they have to go back home and don't get any more work. So the shelf life of most female porn people is 3 weeks, unless you become a star, there's a young girl called Janice Griffiths who's now, got longevity, she's really popular. If you're a Spiegler girl, you can have more time. Whereas the men, I saw the same, four men over and over again.
Really?
Tommy Gunn, Tommy Pistol, Mark Wood, and Small Hands.
Nice, Small Hands.
Small Hands. Those four men, I just saw over and over and over again, whereas I saw the same woman almost never.
So what's Janice
Griffiths.
What's she got, though, that makes her... Is she part of the Spiegler stuff? Or?
Actually, I don't know if she's a Spiegler girl or not.
What gives someone the longevity in the industry?
I think Janice Griffiths is just... She's very charismatic. But it's a real minority.
What's it like being on set? Is it a turn on?
Maybe for the first half an hour, but you get desensitized very, very quickly. On my last day, I was on the set of Amish Girls on Rumspringer Volume 2.
Oh, Jesus.
And the director, Mike Quasar, said to me, who would have thought there was a call for a Volume 2? he said maybe Volume 1 left too many unanswered questions. and I actually walked past. This is really funny. I walked past, they'd cut for a moment.
Yeah.
And I walked past, I won't be too graphic here, but, basically... This young man and young woman were sort of stopped in the act of, sex, and they were just sort of waiting for Mike to change shot or something. And I walked past them without giving them a second look. And they said to me, all three of them said to me, God, you're desensitized. You didn't even glance.
What was the future of podcasts and documentaries then? How do you think? Do you think it's going to be a growing industry? I mean, we'll leave all the visual stuff to Louis Theroux, leave it to him. The old-fashioned Louis Theroux stuff. No, what's going to happen to the audio stuff? Do you think there's money to be made out of these things?
Yeah, there are. I think it's the future of the way that people are going to just consume nonfiction in general. I do. That's how I consume nonfiction.
Yeah, I do
more.
As well.
Yeah, and the more experimental you can be, both in terms of doing long form conversations like this, but also the more kind of intricate storytelling like I did in The Butterfly Effect and like Brian Reed did in S Town. It's going to be a place for mavericks, and I'm really excited about the future of podcasting. And there is a way to make money through advertising, through subscription. I mean, Audible are doing it through the subscription model. So there are ways.
People ask us how we're making money out of this, and we're not. I'm self-funding it, but it's at the moment we don't care because we love it and it's a hobby. And I'm getting to speak to really interesting people, and I know the listeners love it. And it's for me, sometimes it's really good to do something that you're just enjoying and other people are enjoying, and then you think, hopefully one day there'll be a career out of it. Yeah. But I don't care at the moment.
Right, and this was I think it's what Adam Buxton did. I think Adam's doing a brilliant podcast.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah,
and I think he didn't try and get any advertising for the first 20 episodes or whatever, yeah. And then, you know, proved that, you know, people were liking it, and now he's making a bit of money for advertising.
We're episode 42. We're not looking at it yet. We'll look at it soon. Can we talk about Okja?
Sure.
Or Okja. I don't know how's it pronounced.
I think it's Okja.
Okja, the story.
I should know, having
you should know. Consider
it.
You wrote it. The story. Tell us the story.
It's about a young girl whose best friend is a giant pig the size of an elephant, and the pig gets kidnapped by an evil multinational run by Tilda Swinton and Jake Gyllenhaal, and taken from the mountains of Korea to America, where Mija has to rescue Okja before she is slaughtered for her meat.
Two things about it which I thought were interesting. Number one, this is the before I watched it. Number one, the amount of people going, don't watch this if you don't want to be a vegetarian. Mm. And I thought that was just, that's such brilliant PR.
Yeah.
Because I did watch it. I'm still not a vegetarian, but I do understand what they meant. Kate Nash came on Sunday Brunch and said it turned her into a vegan or a vegetarian?
It turned her into a vegan from a vegetarian, because after you told me that a couple of days ago, I tweet, because I'm a big fan of Kate Nash, so I took the opportunity to tweet her and say, that's so great. And she tweeted me back and said, you know, thank you for making it.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah, I'm a vegan.
Thank you for making me a vegan. Yeah exactly. So, and the other thing about, so we'll talk about that in a minute, but let's talk about, first of all, that I like the fact that it was booed because the Netflix logo came up, and it was great PR as well. As soon as I found out something had been booed, I'm like, I want to watch it.
Yeah.
So that even though
I was asleep, it was the 8:30 in the morning screening at Cannes. It was the very first ever public screening, and it was journalists. This is why I think it's a slightly spurious. I think it's a fake controversy. I think it's fake news.
Fake news.
Yeah, because the room was full of journalists. It was journalists.
Right.
So, because the eighth, there's two, when your film's in competition at Cannes, there's basically two screenings, an 8:30 a.m. screening and then a nighttime black tie screening.
Right.
And the 8:30 screening's all, as far as I know, unless there's something I don't know, it's all journalists. So the Netflix logo came up, the journalists booed, and then they all wrote articles about how everybody booed. And they, and they weren't booing the film, they were booing the logo, the Netflix logo. When the Netflix logo, I was asleep. And I woke up and my brother had emailed me saying, well, I suppose all publicity is good publicity. And I'm like, well, what's happened? And then it took me a little while to work out that while I slept, this had happened.
Oh, it's brilliant publicity, because for people like me who are completely hooked to Netflix and Amazon Prime, I'm like, oh, I feel ownership to it then immediately. Yeah. Well, my film.
Yes, well, the black tie event in the evening, when the Netflix logo came up, everybody cheered as a response to what had happened that morning.
Of course, because I like the future. I like it. It's my, I mean, I shouldn't say that really, working in the TV industry, because Netflix is dominating now, seems to be. I mean, people are it's even a common phrase amongst children, let's Netflix and chill. I mean, that's amazing when you become as big as that.
And actually Okja's reopened, I guess, for award season. It's now in cinemas across America this week. So Netflix are putting the film into cinemas.
And they won't, the good thing about Netflix, they won't give out viewing figures, will they? So do you know?
No, I haven't got a clue. Actually, funny
so you don't
enough,
know whether people liked it or not?
No.
Apart from talking to you on Twitter.
Nobody knows. In fact, I Skyped with Tilda Swinton the other day, and she said it's such a weird feeling. Like, when a film comes out, normally you... you know, you can check the figures to see how well the film's done, but with Okja, you can't. So she doesn't know, and she's a producer on the movie.
Yeah. So for anyone who doesn't know, what Netflix do is they decide not to release ratings so they can be creative. So they, if they put something out which doesn't rate, they don't want everyone to say, we've got to cancel it if they like it. And I think it's an amazing idea.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I love the fact that Netflix... The reason why I love the fact that Netflix made this film is because the whole movie is leading up to this incredibly disturbing, poignant, upsetting, heartbreaking, but, you know, beautiful, you know, complicated last 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And before Netflix said that they would make Okja, I was getting the sense that it was going around all the major studios in Hollywood, and they're all like, we'll make this film if you change the ending.
Right.
And my heart was sinking, because the ending was perfect. And then Bong, the director of the film, emailed me and said, it's all okay.
It's happening.
Netflix are going to fund it and they don't want us to change a thing.
Tilda Swinton scares me. Is she scary?
She is so lovely. I've spent quite a lot of time with
her. Come on, you were scared when you first met her though.
The first time I met her was over Skype. She was in South Korea with Bong and her partner Sandro, and we Skyped. And so that was the first time I met her. But the first time I met her in person was at a restaurant in New York. And no, she was lovely. She sat me lovely, normal. She has the same frames of reference as us. So, you know, we talked. You know, one of the very first things we talked about was how much she loved the IT crowd and Father Ted.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So
all right. You know, you're a fish and chippocrit, apparently. Mm. Is that right?
What a pescatarian.
Who calls you that?
A vegetarian said that to me on Twitter because I mentioned that I'm a vegetarian who eats fish. And,
you're a
and
fish and chippocrit. Yeah, I love that.
Said, you know what we call that? Yeah, we call you fish and chippocrit.
That's brilliant. I just wanted to quickly touch on this. Because it's a really interesting concept. I interviewed the guy. Do you remember they made the $325,000 burger once, the man-made burger. So they made it in a laboratory, and $325,000 it was, and you know that, and all the tabloids loved it, the most expensive burger ever. So I interviewed the guys doing I like the future, and I like change, and I like things like I get excited. That's why I'm doing podcasts and stuff. I get excited by it all. And so I was doing a little series of mini documentaries for 4OD, and we interviewed the guy who made the burger, and I said, why are you making it? And he said, there's a group of us who believe in animal welfare, and it's done for that reason, not to generate money. And it really stuck with me, because he goes, in the future, we're going to think killing animals is a very strange thing to do. Simon Anstall, I haven't seen it, but he did a documentary.
Carnage. I haven't seen it either, but apparently it's very good.
About killing animals. And in the future, apparently, we're going to find it really weird to kill animals. So that's obviously the poignant bit in your film, as you discussed.
I think it's true. You know, when you know, I mean, I follow a lot of pigs on Instagram. I follow Esther the Wonder Pig.
Really?
Yeah. Do you know the Esther the Wonder Pig story?
No.
It's such a great story. It's these two gay guys in Canada, and they bought a mini pig. You know, one of these tiny little baby pigs, because they thought it was like cool because they were kind of a bit hipstery and cool. But it turned out that Esther wasn't a mini pig.
Yeah,
she grew
a lot
into this massive fucking pig.
Yeah.
And she lives with them in their home.
Right.
And it's Esther the Wonder Pig, and she's amazing. They dress her up and she's always really happy. And
I'll have to follow her.
Oh yeah, totally. So I follow Esther. I also follow Seymour the Squirrel, which is a domesticated squirrel. I love Seymour. Almost makes me cry at night.
There you go. That's your imagination working overtime for
no,
you.
No, it's not.
No.
What Seymour does?
What?
So every morning, it's in Florida. Every morning, Seymour's owner or Seymour's parent takes Seymour like to the trees. Seymour like jumps off his shoulder, runs around all the other squirrels. When he's tired, just jumps back onto his shoulder and they go back home again.
Oh, that's so sweet.
Yeah.
on that protein thing, I've been looking at the protein thing for a while and working out what's going on with the protein. And apparently the fish protein is very easy to make now.
Right.
Okay.
So, and it's all completely human made.
Yeah. So the theory is that we are going to be making protein very soon. And if we're making protein very soon, we might be able to make human protein.
Right. And will we want to?
Will we? Then that sets, why don't we make protein which is nearest us to if it's nondescript protein? And it's like, then that's a real moral dilemma, isn't it?
Yeah.
Listen, I know we're going to run out of time soon. So okay.
Let me just double check. I just wanted to make sure that nobody had tried to text me. That was important. No,
okay, we've got a cab coming soon for you as well. I think it might be here already. So can we just go on to, so you've been publicly shamed.
Sure.
You got publicly shamed in the end. The book was about publicly shaming. We've discussed it a bit on the show, how everybody came and they went, everyone goes onto the internet and they slam you. You got publicly shamed in the end after doing it. How did that feel?
Bad. It felt very bad. It was a really rough year for me. Because I was like being attacked. Well, A, it was not true. Like, so I brought out this book about, you know, public shame that was critical of public shaming on social media. Not critical of, like, you know, the serious stuff. Like, I'm not, you know, obviously I don't feel in the slightest bit critical about when, you know, Nazis marching on Charlottesville are being publicly shamed, or sexual predators in Hollywood are being publicly shamed. My book was about how easy it is to have, like, miscarriages of justice. So I would concentrate on people who made, like, a joke that came out badly, like a liberal joke that was misconstrued. And I was writing a book about people like that, like people who are massively disproportionately punished for very small offences. But a bunch of people who hadn't read the book basically decided that because I was being critical of public shaming on social media and social justice relies on public shaming as a weapon, that must mean I'm against social justice.
Yeah.
Which I'm not. I am for social justice. You know, I was saying to somebody the other day, like, you know, we're not massively different ages. I mean, when I grew up, you know, Saturday night TV was all racism, misogyny, yeah, and homophobia. You know, I watched Mrs. Doubtfire the other day. It's got racism in it. Mm-hmm. I watched 16 Candles the other day. There's a Chinese character in 16 Candles. Every time the character appears on the screen, a gong goes off. It's like, it's unbelievable. Like, you know, and political correctness is eradicating that stuff from the culture. And I think that's very, very positive. But there's a kind of dark side to public shaming, which is these kind of injudicial outrage mobs who are destroying people who don't deserve it. So I brought this book out, and then people decided to just try and get me because of their idea of what they thought the book was about. Mm. And so for a year, like I'd wake up in the middle of the night and there'd be like 900 Twitter notifications because I was being like doxxed. And it was awful. You know, much of my self-worth is wrapped up in my work, in how well I do my work. And so it was a really rough year for me.
And the problem with it is, I find, is if they looked at your back catalogue, you would see there's a genuine person there who cares about the world and is creative and is, artistic and intelligent. Yet they're going to basically all jump on a bandwagon about one thing someone says.
Take a sliver, the tiniest sliver of
somebody. And try and bring you down.
Yeah, and then just decide. I mean, you know, over and over again, people are being defined on social media by this sliver of their lives.
Yeah.
A tweet, you know, that nobody knows anything else about. I'm not talking about public figures. I'm talking about, like, private individuals.
Yeah. But what happens with it when you're people like us is if the person has credibility, like a journalist, mm-hmm, one of our colleagues, so, you know, one of our... Then people go, well, it must be true then if something happens like that. So then you end up with people looking at you and going, well, it's got to be true because why is anyone going to lie? And it's very strange. And it's funny because I'm on TV, I never get involved in political things. I never get involved in jumping on the bandwagons with any of those things because I just don't want to get involved in it, really. I think I've got too much to lose, really. But were you one of the people originally who were jumping on going, he's got to go, get rid of him and all that sort of...
I think I was at the very beginning when you know, public shaming on social media was very new. I remember a few things happened that felt, you know, very positive. I remember there was this pregnant woman who belonged to LA Fitness. This is one of the first great Twitter shamings.
Yeah.
And she wanted to cancel her membership because she'd lost her job and LA Fitness refused to let her cancel her membership.
So you jumped on that.
Yeah, so we all jumped on that and LA Fitness, like, very hastily backtracked.
We were discussing the other day, though, what's the good thing about it is when you look at the Hollywood scandals at the moment or the MP scandals or any of that sort of, it gives people a voice to go, hey, it happened to me. And that's where it works, doesn't it?
And when you've been, obviously, like, when you've been, like, victimised, when you've been the victim of sexual harassment or bullying and, you know, the court system, you know, has let you down, you know, of course, when something like this happens, it's positive. Mm. I mean, you know, as we said right at the beginning of this conversation, it's like, you know, there's still pitfalls.
Yeah.
But, you know, basically what's happening is really important and valuable social change.
John, it's been a pleasure talking to you. I know we're running out of time here because we've got places to go. You've got places to go and stuff. Can I just ask you the questions we ask everybody who comes on the show?
Yes.
First of all, what advice were you given that's been invaluable to your life?
Well, you know what? I alluded to this earlier on in the conversation.
Right.
So the very first thing I ever did, like beyond writing a column in Time Out, was I did this TV show for BBC Two called The Ronson Mission, and it wasn't very good. And, I would argue that we had our moments, but
right,
it basically
okay.
wasn't good. And I was pretty unemployable for a little while afterwards. And I said to the producer, Neil Crombie, who now produces like Grace and Perry stuff, he's a very accomplished
yeah.
arts producer. I said, I'm not sure if I'm going to get any more work because like people hated our show so much. And I was like 25. And I can't remember exact words, he basically said to me, like, you know, don't wait. You're John Ronson. You're like, don't wait for somebody to give you permission to work. Just go out and do it. Like, hustle, you know, just go out and do it. Don't wait for somebody to allow. And I think that's like the best advice I've
ever
had.
Easier to do it than ever at the moment. You can self-publish if you want to write a book.
Right.
You can go and start a YouTube channel. You can do a podcast. So
yeah.
You know, now's the time to do it. What mistake do people make, maybe doing your job? I wonder if it could be connected to documentary making or anything. Mm. What mistake do people make?
You know what? The mistake I tend to make, and I'm getting much better at it, is like if an editor wants me to write a story that I don't feel that passionate about, but maybe I'm feeling a bit paranoid because I haven't got much work on that week, or the editor's like very persuasive and I'm easily persuaded, I agree to do a story that I don't feel particularly passionate about. That story is rarely very good.
Right.
So I would say if you're going to do a story, only do stories that you really want to tell.
Perfect. Any life hacks?
What does that mean?
Well, the one I always say, which is my favourite, the one I came up with once, was if you don't want to smoke, never put another cigarette in your mouth, which people have laughed at, John, but
right.
It's something that can help people with their life.
So like an easy, small...
Yeah. Something maybe in travelling, you do a lot of travel. Is there any hacks in travelling or anything? Or...
You know what? If you possibly can, try not to be woken up artificially. I know that's easier said than
no,
done for some
Mir
people.
No, Mir Kreiger says that he's the leading sleep expert in the world. Try and wake up without an alarm.
Yeah.
Very important.
Yeah, that changes my life massively.
What's it like to be famous?
You know what? Actually, you know, many, many years ago, Zoe Ball, when she was at the height of her fame, said to me, because we were friends back then, I mean, I still would like, it's not like we fell out, just kind of drifted, you know, apart a bit.
That's the headline, John. That's what we heard.
I remember she said to me one time, I think I was in her flat and there was a photographer hiding in the bushes outside her flat waiting for her to come out. And she said to me, I really envy you because you're famous enough to like for it to kind of be good for your ego, but you're not so famous that it affects the quality of your life. And I've always managed to maintain that level of fame.
And the final question, what is the meaning of life?
Well, I'm not the right person to ask because I worry all the time. And, you know, I'm worried. All I do is kind of work. I mean, now that my son's 19... I just work. I work and I go to the gym and that's my entire life, like nothing else.
Perfect. John, thank you so much for coming on. If they want to...
But that's not the meaning of life. That means I failed at the meaning of life.
All right, okay. Yeah. If they want to come and see the psychopath talk, is it called?
When are you putting this up?
Well, I think it should go up within the next week or so.
Well, you know what? Our shows are almost entirely sold out, thank heavens, except for Coventry, where Icarus, like... We flew too close to the sun. So could everybody please travel to Coventry to see me at...
Coventry, okay.
So, you know what? It's a podcast, so I can tell you this. So we are doing...
Yeah.
I'm going to tell you all of our dates. There's only six dates. Saturday, the 11th of November, Tyne Theatre in Newcastle. Sunday, the 12th, Liverpool Philharmonic. Monday, the 13th, Brighton Dome. Tuesday, the 14th. Coventry. 15th is London, 16th is Cardiff.
I'm there on the 15th.
Right.
I'll wave at you.
Yeah, but
I won't put you off, but I'll wave.
London sold out. Cardiff's practically sold out. I think there's a couple of tickets left in Brighton and Liverpool and Newcastle, and there's many tickets left in Coventry.
Coventry. Get to Coventry. Yeah. And if you want to follow you, John, what's your Twitter address?
It's at John Ronson, no H, JonRonson. And on Instagram, I am also John Ronson.
Thank you so much for coming on. It's
Tim,
been
it's
absolutely
a pleasure
brilliant.
Talking to you.
Thank you.
Thank
Cheers.
You.
John Ronson there. I've thoroughly enjoyed that. I looked down at my stopwatch halfway through that and I thought, oh, we've been going so long here and it feels like only 5 minutes. I reckon I could have talked to him for a good 2-3 hours. Sadly, I knew he had to get off and do something. He's doing some more writing and had to get off. Otherwise, I think he would have probably sat and talked for 2 or 3 hours, wouldn't he?
He's amazing. You can ask him a question or set him up on a subject and he just has so much to say and it's all really engaging.
Yeah, he's one of those guys when you meet them, you want them to be as you think they're going to be, and he genuinely is. It's about the third or fourth time I've met him now, and every time I find myself just engaging with him so much about all sorts of different subjects. I'm upset we didn't get to talk about Frank Sidebottom because I love talking to him about that. He was obviously in Frank's band. So next time we get him on, we've got to get him on and talk about that. And I wanted really to talk to him more about You've Been Publicly Shamed, but I think we got a lot out of it.
Oh, yeah.
So I'd like, he knows so much about that subject and it's so interesting because we're all attached to social media and it's not going away. Definitely not going away. Hey Mark, the genie's out of the bottle. So we've got to just make sure we know what we're doing with social media. And it's interesting what's happening with it at the moment. And John has got so many great views on it. We discussed if you were to get involved in it, what you should do. And I don't want to do it now because John's got some theories on what you should do if you're one of the people who'd been focused on who did it and the mistakes
made. That'd be a good special to do about that, about social media, about it, if you've ever had a backlash on it, because a lot of people have.
Oh yeah, if anyone has had anything like that happen, write in and let us know what happened.
We could even get it to John and see if he's got any answers.
Yes, exactly right. So anyway, I hope you enjoyed that. Mark and I will be back really soon with one of our ones where we just sit and chat and do our agony column.
We're thinking, much prefer the interviews.
No, we've got some really good problems coming up. It's just we've got some good interviews as well. We're trying to juggle both and we don't want to put too many out a week at the moment. You know, we really don't know what we're doing. We're just doing it.
I mean, I think that's clear.
Yeah, we're just going along and seeing what we can do and how we're putting them out. But we're really enjoying it and that's half the battle. I hope you're enjoying it too. So we'll see you all on Monday. And I think on Monday we've got another special.
We've got another special.
Who have we got Monday? Ronnie O'Sullivan.
Yeah.
Ronnie O'Sullivan, which is great. You're really going to enjoy that. And then we'll be back real soon with one of... Real soon. We'll be back real soon with one of ours.
Okay, mate.
We've got to record one soon. Anyway, that's it from us. We'll see you next time. And from now, peace and love, joy.
I've completely forgotten about this.
Peace and love, joy. Peace and love, joy.
Bye.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.